Be seated, please. The court is ready to hear argument in 050729 Exxon Corporation versus Emerald Oil and Gas.
May I please inform you that I have a question of argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 6 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I am here today along with Ms. Marla Broadus representing Exxon in connection with this case. This case and the case to be submitted following this case all arise out of a dispute between Exxon and landowners, royalty owners, and a subsequent lessee of the property.
Mr. Ratliff, can you address the standing issue?
Yes, sir.
Me, please.
I would address the standing issue. What happened in this case, in this particular appeal, and if you, in order to not get totally confused, I had to make myself a booklet, and you'll find behind the overview the claims in green that are the subject of this particular dispute. The only claims here are claims by Emerald. Emerald was a subsequent lessee. It had no contractual relationship with Exxon. It was not in privity of estate with Exxon. It simply came into the property almost 3 years after Exxon's lease terminated and the property was abandoned by Exxon, leased a portion of the property. And if I might, Mr. Chief Justice, if I can point out here, in blue, you will see the area that was originally under lease to Exxon. These leases were granted back in the 1950s. They produced in the 1990s very, very substantial royalty income and other income to the working interest owners. In red, you see the section that in 1993 was leased by Emerald. Emerald, in this case, brought suit and sought to recover against Exxon for breach of the regulatory duty not to commit waste, for breach of the regulatory duty to plug well properly, and for negligence per se, based upon violations of three cited provisions in the Natural Resources Code. To go to the issue of standing, first of all, I don't believe it is seriously contested that at common law, Emerald would have no standing to complain of damages or injury to land that occurred prior to the time that Emerald had an ownership interest in that land. But I do think that's going to be important when we reach the question of the proper interpretation of the statutory provision upon which the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals relies. Similarly, I don't think it is disputed that there was nothing in any of the conveyances of the leasehold or other conveyances from the O'Connors and the Meeshes, the lessors of this land, to Emerald. There was nothing in there that conveyed to them any cause of action relating to damage prior to their ownership interest. And we cited in our brief a large number of cases that simply say, therefore, under the common law, Emerald absolutely lacked any standing to sue for those injuries. Now, what was it that in the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals changed its view? Corpus Christi Court of Appeals, in our view, for the first time held that 85.321 of the Natural Resources Code gave to someone who owns an interest at any time the right to sue and bring a claim for a violation of the waste statutes that are cited in the section, for violation of any other waste statute, and for violation of a valid commission rule or regulation relating to waste. Our view is that if you study the original enactment, which was contained in the 1931 laws that were passed in order to rectify or attempt to rectify a situation in East Texas where, because of the rule of capture, landowners were drilling wells immediately adjacent to each other, damming up creeks and running oil into them so they could prevent their neighbor from draining the property. Those statutes were passed. At the time they were passed, we were in the infancy of administrative law, and people with strong property rights ideas wanted to make sure that there was no way that the powers of the commission, the powers of the AG, any of the powers being granted in that enactment, which was quite extensive, there was no way that that was going to deprive them of their common law right. We say that 85321 does not constitute the granting of a new cause of action. That what it says, when you read it is a preservation statute that makes it clear that the existence of a commission power to do something about waste, the provision of for the Attorney General to pursue claims to prevent waste, the fact that the commission can hold hearings and enter orders, none of those are to abridge or delay the right of a private owner to bring a claim. And the statute says in that claim, and if you can look in the book, we have set out a standing analysis, and then we have the original enactment that this section is a part of. What we believe that language says, when taken in its original text and when it was codified, the legislature specifically said they were not attempting to change it. We believe that what that language says is that if you have the same rights at law or in equity to sue, even though there's a violation of a rule, regulation, or statute dealing with waste, you have not been deprived of that right. And we base that not only on the language of the statute, and as we pointed out in the brief, when the statute was codified, the codifiers flipped the order of the statute. But when you look at it as it was originally enacted, and that's behind a tab marked original enactment, it starts off with nothing herein contained or authorized, and no suit by or against the commission, and no penalties imposed, shall impair, abridge, or delay. And then we get to this portion of the statute.
So I understand, under 85.321, are you saying that had Emeril owned the property or an interest at the time the damage occurred or allegedly occurred, then they could sue under this statute?
No, sir, I'm not, Mr. Chief Justice. What I'm saying is two things. I think that is a secondary reason. If the court disagrees with me on 85.321, that is a secondary reason that Emeril is not in a position, because we say the statute contains a temporal requirement, and that is that you be an owner at the time the damage is inflicted.
Then how do you address the Heckey case that, in which we held when the mineral interest owner is damaged by a violation of conservation law 85.321, then it provides for a damage suit against the operator?
Well, first of all, I'm going to get out on dangerous ground here and say I don't believe that was a holding. That was cited in a footnote after Justice Owen had also pointed out that under the facts of the HECI case, they would have had a common law right under Elliff versus Texon Drilling Company. I believe that footnote is, one, not inconsistent with what we argue, because in that case, the Neals had a common law claim for damage to the reservoir under the adjoining tract under the exact analysis of Elliff versus Texon Drilling. And therefore, we don't believe that's inconsistent. But I would also say to Your Honor that we do not believe, in any event, that that is holding. And I would also like to say that there are a number of other cases that the Corpus Court of Appeals said had similar holdings. We would submit to you that if you read Sledge, if you read N. Ray Apache Corporation, if you read the Fifth Circuit case in Turnbow versus Lamb, all of those cases either are simply mentioning it in passing, or they are simply saying we're not deciding that issue at all. But I think there's something very important in terms of what this statutory provision did. If you look again under the original enactment, and you look in the caption of the law, and the Co-Construction Act says one of the places that the courts may look for legislative intent is in the caption or title of the statute. In this title, and it goes on for some time, since this was under the old provision of the Constitution, that if there was a defect in the caption and it failed to give adequate notice of what was in the statute, that provision would be invalid. We now, that's no longer the law, that's been amended. But I do think this is a very substantial guide to the legislative intent. And if you notice, we've gone through and highlighted every time it authorized a suit or an action, it specifically mentions in the caption. Until you arrive at the language in Section 13 of this enactment, which is now in 85321 and 85322, and all it says there is, provided that nothing herein contained or authorized and no suit by or against the commission shall impair, abridge, or delay any cause of action for damages or other relief of any person owning any land or any producer of crude petroleum or natural gas or any other party of interest may have or assert against any party violating such rule, regulation, or order of the commission or any judgment rendered therein. Not a single indication in the caption that the legislature thought it was creating a cause of action that did not exist prior to that time. Now, there is an alternative basis available with regard to the claims made in this appeal on behalf of Emerald, and that is subsequent events in the trial court established as a matter of law that the claims by Emerald are barred by the statute of limitations. There is uncontroverted evidence, and as a matter of fact, if you look at page 5 of Emerald's brief on the merits, they concede that Emerald knew at the time it entered the first well in August of 1991 that there was what they call junk in the hole, and it violated legal rules and statutes, and yet they didn't file suit within 2 years. So any tort claim that Emerald might have would be barred by statute of limitations, and I would submit under this court's authority in Progressive County Mutual, this is exactly the kind of subsequent event. This is what the evidence that was developed in the trial that is the subject of the next item of submission.
I don't recall if it was in this opinion or the other, but the Court of Appeals says that there's evidence that there's going to be some violations, some junk in the hole in just about all of these operations, but that's not noticed the pervasive, extensive sabotaging of all of the wells.
That's correct. They attempted to use the PPG case to say that therefore you weren't on notice. The fact of the matter is that, and this is indicated if you look at the back under the sample Railroad Commission filings, the fact of the matter is at that time it has to be uncontroverted that they knew there was something in the well that was not disclosed on the Railroad Commission filings. They knew that it was causing them substantial harm. I just would suggest you read on page 5 of Emerald's brief where they say that they knew something was amiss. Now, the question is not whether they then knew all the damage that might occur. There's also another error in the Court of Appeals opinion. It says that there were 121 wells they were going to reenter. Those 121 wells were on the entire lease, not on the area that Emerald had a lease on. And therefore, clearly, they continued to reenter these wells and said they encountered the same problems. And they notified the royalty owners. Excuse me, Your Honor.
Sir. Are there any other questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument then from the respondent.
May I please report, Ms. Hankson will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. We have no quarrel with the common law rule. We quarrel with Exxon's effort to rewrite Section 85.321 of the Texas Natural Resources Code by both adding language to the statute and deleting language to the statute. This court, 9 years ago, read the statute. It was plain on its face. In Heckey, it said there was also created a statutory cause of action. Five different court appeals in the course of writing opinions in this state have looked at the plain language and said there's a cause of action created. The Fifth Circuit on the original statute twice said the same thing. The result of Exxon's bold arguments asking you to ignore the plain language of the statute not only undermines legislative intent, as evidenced by that plain language, it undermines the legislature's comprehensive approach to protecting oil and gas, which is a constitutionally protected, limited natural resource that is essential to the economy of this state.
Why wasn't the common law enough?
Because there are gaps, as this case shows. First of all, under the common law, when you're dealing with common law waste, as this court recognized in Ellis, the common law standing rule is you have to own the property. But the property ownership does not always stay in the same place. And certainly, as we've learned over time, with the fact that contamination, for example, can move underground, with the fact that ownership changes, the bottom line is that there are people who can be left out by the common law rule.
Would such a person be the next successor lessee? How far down the chain could you go? Emerald comes in and they claim damages because they can't reenter the wells. They give up, surrender the lease. Somebody else comes in. Would they have a damage claim?
They could, Your Honor. I guess it depends on the circumstances. Remember that this particular case presents very unique circumstances because the legislature has provided with the public record system as a protection to where we would never hopefully get to this point, that you use those records. So the bottom line is that we have several different things in the legislative scheme coming together. The point, though, is that the legislature very clearly acted against waste in all circumstances.
But it would be an odd situation if a lessee could come in, like in this situation, sue, recover damages, go away, and the mineral owners try to lease it again, succeed. Another lessee thinks he can do better, comes in, encounters the same problems, sues, and gets damages.
You would have all kinds of protection under those circumstances. You would have limitations, Your Honor, under those all particular right. circumstances. You would have the fact that someone had been made whole. If the royalty owners go out and release the property, having already known that the state of the wells and the recovery, you've got all kinds of other things at work. And that's what Exxon wants the court to believe, that this creates a parade of horribles when it doesn't. This is a gap filler. We have brought you a claim that fills squarely within the gap that the statute was intended to fill. The plain language shows that's the case. All we are asking the court to do is to apply the statute to the facts before the court. I believe, Your Honor, that given the fact that it is a gap filler, it's going to be difficult.
But the common law doesn't seem to have treated this as a gap. They treated the requirement of contemporaneous ownership as a part of the essential cause of action, so that to say this is a gap seems like it's really an add-on rather than...
Well, it is an add-on. It is true. But it fills a gap in terms of the fact that someone can be injured under this comprehensive scheme that the legislature has set up, which includes, Your Honor, a very strong component of private enforcement. There is no question that the state has set up a system that requires private enforcement. And what the legislature did in 85.321 was set up a circumstance in which it said to private parties, help us enforce the waste laws.
That's another problem. It's a little odd in the sense that it doesn't set a standard. Is this a strict liability provision or negligence?
Your Honor, there's a defense provided. Violation of the laws. The laws are very precise. Your Honor, if you look, for example, in our bench materials, you can see under tab 7, here's an example, with the plugging rules that are very, very precise in terms of this. Under the plugging rules, there's a good faith defense. But similarly, under 321, the parameters and the availability of this statute are very limited. Note that there is a defense for the reasonably prudent operator. If acting as a reasonably prudent operator is a defense, then it seems to me we're not talking about negligence claims. You are talking about very egregious circumstances. Here we have an intentional tort. There's no challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence that Exxon did what the plaintiffs claimed that they did, including lying in the Railroad Commission records. No challenge to any of it. So you're not talking, the standard is here.
Well, but
it is limited by the defense.
But do you think, that was what I was pointing to, do you think that if the operator just messed up, I mean, he dropped something in the hole he shouldn't have, and there it was, but he's leaving anyway, so he just pours concrete on top of it, takes off. You could argue that a reasonably prudent operator wouldn't do that.
I don't know. I think it depends. I think it would be a matter of the facts of the case. And I mean, I think that that's why the legislature put this in here. I think the legislature was concerned. It set up a comprehensive waste scheme that requires private enforcement for it to work. And it was designed to be in a circumstance. Exxon has come here and said, we can do this with impunity. We can sabotage an entire field with a constitutionally protected limited resource having been destroyed as a result of it. We can file false reports that people rely upon, and there is absolutely no remedy under state law. I mean, that's what they're here saying to you. I doubt seriously that if Exxon were on the other side, and Emerald had done this, they'd be saying the same thing.
A couple of questions about that. it's a little unusual to have a cause of action for filing a report of an agency that has misstatements in it. Maybe there should be. But you think whatever the report was and whatever it said, you might have a cause of action.
No, because it's not a mistake here.
It's not what?
It's not a mistake here. These were intentionally filed as false reports. I mean, that evidence is not disputed in the record that was tried. Of course, this statutory claim went away before trial, but the record in the second case shows that to be the circumstance. Under the plugging rules, there is a defense for the good faith effort. So it seems to me that trying to do it right and not quite getting it is not going to be actionable. All right? I mean, the point is that the legislature did put parameters in place. It did cabin in what it is that it would allow as a private enforcement mechanism under 85.321. But the bottom line is that, Your Honor, if you look at it in our materials at tab 1, the plain language of the statute clearly provides for the cause of action.
I forget about it, one other point that you made earlier. You say has injured or impaired a constitutionally protected resource, the mineral on the ground. Hasn't this just made it harder to get at them? But really, they're not really lost, are they?
They are, Your Honor. Exxon's producing the adjoining lease. This is a common reservoir.
But, I mean, unless he could drill another well.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I mean, and that's what, and of course, we never got to that point, and that's what the evidence at trial was about. There was expert testimony under reliable methodology used every day by Exxon and every other operator in the state of Texas that showed there are circumstances where you cannot produce the oil. And the other thing that you have working is when you have a common reservoir, Exxon did this to this lease and was over on the adjoining lease producing out of the common reservoir. That is a loss to the royalty owners because under Texas law, they have the right to be able to produce under, you know, off their lease.
And but so, why can't you just move over 10 feet and drill another well?
Because that's all regulated as well, Your Honor. But that's part of the But that's part of the damage claim. I agree with you. And that was part of the damage formulation that I know Ms. O'Neill is going to talk to you about in the next case. But the bottom line is that that was part of what was discussed. But the point
it seems
is
to
that
me that if all you do has done, if all you've done is make it harder, more expensive, that that's a different claim from saying that it's lost altogether, like you vented it or you poured it out on the ground.
Well, but both of those things, I mean, depending on the circumstances, there are circumstances in which you could drill a new well to try to recover. In other circumstances, given the damage that is done to the formation as a result of the damaging of the well bore, you actually can be in a position where you are unable to produce what is there.
Emerald knew as early as 1991 that there was junk in the hole, as the Court of Appeals is terming that. Why wouldn't that begin running the limitations period?
Well, first of all, if I may, Your Honor, this particular claim has never been the subject of limitations defense, and it's not in this appeal. I mean, I'm happy to talk about it right now with you since
well,
you
we'll
asked.
Well, we'll get to it in the next.
But, I mean, if you want me to, I will, because the bottom line is that what the record shows in the trial is that it is not unusual to encounter junk when you go into a well. You can encounter cut casing. And it doesn't mean that someone has deliberately harmed the well, because there could have been an effort to pull the casing, unable to get it out, and then you're allowed to leave it. So the things that Exxon is talking about are not the things that would give you notice of the wrongful injury, as Justice Brister has talked about in his recent opinions on limitations. Second of all, Emerald has a fraudulent inducement defense to limitations as well, which is relegated to a footnote in their brief in the second case because of the records. And what you've got is a case. The reason why this case is a discovery rule case is you have everything entombed in the ground. You couple that with the one public source of information being a lie. Public records that the state of Texas holds out to induce people to do exactly what Emerald did, and that Exxon lied in the records. What you have is an exercise of diligence on the part of Emerald's part. It's throughout the trial record. You have them bringing in reworking experts. You have them trying to get information from Exxon. You have them working those wells. You have them checking public records. They're doing all of these things. This is not like the other cases. This is damage in the ground, under the ground, covered up, false public records, due diligence being exercised. And it is not until they get the well records from Exxon's partner on the adjoining track that they determine what has happened. So the fact is it's the due diligence, Your Honor, that shows that the things that they were finding are not unusual in the field, and that's what the record is.
Nobody mentions this, I don't think, but has the commission been involved in all of this, in any of this at all?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. And that is not unusual, Your Honor.
You say in your brief that the Railroad Commission carefully regulates plugging so that reentry is not impaired. So
they do so, again, through the bottom line is, Your Honor, there are three aspects to the regulatory scheme in Texas. There's the public role, there is the private enforcement, and there's the self-policing. The bottom line is that there are 356,000 oil and gas and injection wells in Texas right now. In 2005, there were 6,160 plugging reports that were filed. The Railroad Commission only has 716 full-time employees, 60% of them at the headquarters in Austin. They're not out watching these wells be plugged. They're not out policing all of that. That's why, when you put it in context with the entirety of the scheme the legislature has set up, that's why this cause of action is so important. That's why it's a component. Exxon wants you to leave the impression that the Railroad Commission is watching everything everybody's doing out in the field. That is not the case.
Let me ask you about another phrase in the statute that not discussed much. It says the party who owns an interest in property or production may be damaged. And in this case, Emerald's interest in the property or production is its interest as a lessee.
Correct.
From the mineral owners. But does that mean that that interest carries with it a right to easy reentry, I guess, is it seems to me the damage here, or at least part of the damage that's asserted, is that it's going to be harder and more expensive for us to reenter these wells.
If we can do it at all.
And that has to, I guess the position has to be that that's part of the lessee's interest that he gets.
The interest at the lessee, when it leases the property, it then leases, it gets an interest in the production and the obligation then to actually go in and re-enter and try to reproduce these wells. And certainly, so there is a real property interest. So that's the
interest. Why does that interest contain as a component the right to get at it easy?
Well, there is the right to rely upon the entirety of the legislative scheme. Remember that the legislature...
You think that comes with the property interest?
I do. I think that when you lease it, under those circumstances, again, remember that part of Exxon's cause of action is tied to the fact that they filed these false plugging reports that the legislature has required and the Railroad Commission have required to be filed for the very purpose of having subsequent operators come along. As we end up with Texas being a mature oil production state, these abandoned wells are really important. People are going in. The legislature has put tax incentives in place. And the point is that an operator has an obligation. They've got to be under oath. They're verified reports that people are entitled to rely upon them. The bottom line is that, Your Honor, if you read the statute and you look at who may sue, clearly they own an interest because they're the lessee on this particular property. The bottom line is violating laws, rules, or orders prohibiting waste, and you get down in terms of what they can sue for. They can sue for the violation of the provisions of the regulations in the statute. The regulations include how the wells are, you know, about the state of the wells as the way they were plugged and the reports. The point is that your aspect of your question, Your Honor, comes under the provision of the fact that you can sue someone for violating those provisions. And that's where that kicks in.
I think Justice Johnson had
I'm
a
sorry.
Question.
Counsel, I was understanding Justice Heck's question here is when you own an interest in property or production, who owns the real estate between the surface and the reservoir?
Well, I mean, the minerals...
That's where the bore is.
Right.
And,
but
and
it's
the
part
mineral,
of the lease. It's now part of the lease.
So part of the lease, and this record is shown to be
right.
The hole in the ground that goes from the surface to the reservoir and the equipment in there, whatever it is, whether it's casing or whatever.
Right.
So that's encompassed within
right.
the lease.
That's right. The point is if I just could finish answer to Justice Heck's question, it's an interest in property or production that may be damaged by another party violating the provision. So that interest has been damaged by the violation of the regulations and the statute. That's how the statute reads, and that's how Emerald gets in the position of having a cause of action. I'm sorry, Justice Wainwright.
Address the language that, the argument that the language that's been, you've been focusing on requires some contemporaneous violation. The language here is another party violating the provisions of this chapter. It doesn't say who has violated or violating or has violated. It says violating, which the argument is suggests contemporaneous damage.
That's not grammatically what that language means. And if anything, if it does, then there's an ongoing violation so long as those false records are on file with the state. But the bottom line is the way grammatically you look at this sentence, the verb is may sue and recover. That's a present tense. A party may sue and recover. The language that you are quoting is serving as an adjective. as is the language in the first clause serving as an adjective that is modifying and describing who can sue and who may be sued. And if you look at all of all the decisions I talked about, the five different courts of appeals, the Fifth Circuit, and this court, and the language, you see that what's at issue is the violation of the statute.
Heckey, you're right, but Heckey makes the statement about a cause of action, but Heckey doesn't say whether it needs to be contemporaneous violation or past violation. Heckey just makes the statement. I'm trying to focus on the language in this adjective, as you described it, in this that says by another party violating the provisions. What is there language, let me ask it a different way, in this provision that you think indicates that a subsequent interest owner can be injured by another party violating the provision, instead of it saying having violated or violated in the past the provision?
Well, but Your Honor, the language that you're reading grammatically encompasses exactly what you're talking about. There is no temporal limitation in the language that you read grammatically given the drafting of the statute. I mean, you are reading it as there being a limitation, and grammatically that is not the way it reads. And if you read Heckey, the way Justice Owen wrote Heckey, it says when a mineral or royalty interest owner is damaged by a violation of the conservation laws. That's what this language means. If you're damaged by a violation of the law. And there is a violation of the law here. In fact, there is more than one violation of the law. And we were damaged by it because we went in relying on records that the law said, in an effort to prevent waste, must be sworn and accurately reflect what happened in a plugging report. And when we purchased, at that point in time, we were damaged by the violation. We were further damaged when we got into the wells and realize that there was field-wide sabotage by Exxon, who claims there is no way under Texas law for them to be held liable for that.
And are there any further questions? Thank you. The court will hear rebuttal.
Mr. Ratliff, I want to pick up on that argument of Ms. Hankinson there, and that it's undisputed in the record that Exxon lied to the Railroad Commission, and therefore there's a cause of action that they should be able to pursuant to their reading of the statute.
That's absolutely wrong. And when she says that there are all these findings about all this conduct, remember, these emerald claims we're talking about here didn't even survive summary judgment in the trial court. And I'm glad you asked the question, though, because if you'll look in the booklet and you look under the tab sample Railroad Commission filings, all the filings that they say misled them and caused them all this damage, if you look at Defendant's Exhibit 379, this is an example, and I'd invite the court's analysis of all of them that are in the record. It's a Form W-3 file, and if you'll look down, it says casing and tubing record after plugging. One of their complaints is that you left tubing in the hole, and that made it more expensive. It says put in the well, left in the well, exactly the same amount. It says for two different sizes of tubing. Secondly, if you'll look at behind that, there's a D-5 form filed by the Railroad Commission staff itself, either based on inspection or based on information supplied by the operator. And behind that, there's a write-up, and it says on the D-5 report, the operator cut the 5.5-inch casing at 1,400 feet with a mechanical cutter. Then at the bottom, the operator will then cut the 5.5-inch casing 1,300 feet and squeeze another plug on Monday at between 1,300 and 1,100 feet. These were the records that they say misled them as to what the condition of the well was, because their complaint, exactly what Justice Heck said, they said it has been made more difficult for us. But there's a very important fact here, and that is that no waste has been committed in the terms of the Railroad Commission. If that oil and gas is below the ground in recoverable amounts that are economic to produce, it is still there. And as Justice Heck said, you can kick the rig over 50 feet and drill the well. Remember, this case, was based on $20 oil. The question is it economic at the time the lessee either has the lease and has the obligation to develop, or is it economic now? If it is not economic to recover it from the ground up, there can be no waste. It is there. Let me speak to another point that's not in this case. Council referred several times to the fact that Exxon was producing on an adjoining tract along with Quintana. There is no drainage claim in this case by anyone, working interest or royalty interest owner. No drainage claim. And if you look at Amoco versus Alexander, even if there were, Amoco Alexander says drainage of oil and gas from one lease tract to another with a different set of royalty owners may be drainage, but it is not waste. So that is not in this case. Council pointed to the reasonable and prudent operator defense as somehow supporting her position as to the proper interpretation of 85321. The reasonable and prudent operator defense was added to this statute in 1987. That's about 56 years after it was enacted. There can be, the subsequent legislature may well have put that in there for what they believe was good reason, but it does not change the original intent of the statute. Interestingly, in this argument by Emerald, they say, well, 85321 is a gap filler. It's simply there to address a situation where a stranger to the title is now allowed to come in and sue. The fact of the matter is, as you will hear in the next argument, the royalty owners similarly rely on 85321, and it will be interesting to hear the gap that supposedly is going to fill. Let me point.
Let me ask yes, just sir. A quick procedural question.
Sure.
The Court of Appeals noted that the claim, that Emerald's claim in the trial court was under several statutes and
yes,
rule, and then found that there was a cause of action under 32.321. Does that comprehend the claims under the other statutes, 011 and 046, Rule 360? Are they all bound up in this one question about a cause of action under 321? Or do we have
I think they're bound up in the sense that if they don't have standing to assert it,
Under 321,
and there's nothing that gives them, as a stranger to the title, the power to assert it any other way. So I believe they are bound up in it, Mr. Justice Hecht.
But there's not another question out there, is there a cause of action under 011 or 045 or 046?
Well, we contend there is not.
But if there is, it's still bound up in 321.
It's still bound up, I think, in 321. Let me kind of... There went my life. I apologize. Thank you.
We'll come back to the other aspect of this case after we take a brief recess.